Hello and welcome to the Technically Legal Podcast. This is episode 49 for May 11th, 2010. My name is Ben Snakehoff and I'll be your host this week. With me today, we've got
Dominic Ramier,
David Liu,
and David O'Brien.
We've got three great stories for you, a double dose of the FCC. First, we're going to talk about taking another stab at net neutrality. Secondly, we're going to talk about selectable output control and why they're giving content companies control over your TV. And thirdly, we're going to talk about the DOJ and FTC possibly investigating Apple for some antitrust issues that we discussed on a previous podcast. But a little more in depth this week because we've gotten some new information. So first off, we're going to talk about the FCC taking another stab at net neutrality. We talked a couple of weeks ago about the fact that the FCC recently suffered a big loss in the net neutrality battle. There was a case with Comcast over filtering filtering is an accurate enough term. BitTorrent traffic, Dominic, that's an accurate enough term. Is there another word that we use for it?
Throttling. Dropping connections.
Throttling. That's the word I was looking
traffic
for.
Traffic shipping.
Yeah, they were inserting drop packets into peer-to-peer connections, and therefore making it much more difficult to transfer files, even totally legitimate and copyright-free files, across these networks. FCC decided to institute a fine against Comcast, and Comcast challenged the FCC's authority to impose that fine. And the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals basically said, yes, that is correct. The FCC does not have authority to enforce net neutrality under the way they currently regulate broadband. So people speculated for a while as to what was going to happen, and the FCC came out this past week and said, well, we've got a couple of ideas, and here they are, and they released an opinion paper, and we'll put that up on the site. Essentially, what this says is that we're going to try to, the FCC, one of the tactics that they're going to take is try to reclassify broadband as a common carrier as opposed to an information service. And a common carrier is something like I guess the easiest analogy is like a telephone service. So the telephone services, I mean, they're all subject to a lot of regulations and it's all very confusing. They have to carry across their lines whatever, you know, people decide to send across the telephone lines. They can't selectively, you know, pick and choose what telephone traffic they want. If somebody wants to make a call, these people have to agree to carry that call. The premise of that comes from like buses. Buses are like a bus route. Like Greyhound is a common carrier. But what the FCC did is they tried to apply, you know, that kind of mentality of you have to carry this stuff across. You can't discriminate against who you're going to drive places to information and voice, and now they're going to try to apply it to data. So, David or Dominic or other David, anyone want to chime in with, you know, what you think the regulatory procedure is going to be here? You know, what are the steps between now and, you know, when we actually see something?
Well, if memory serves, they're probably going to have to release a series of reports that propose the amendments themselves and open them up to public comments. Is that right, Ben?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's right. They're going to have to, you know, put out a proposal, subject it to an open comment period, and then, you know, I imagine that people are going to write in a lot of comments. They then have to respond to those comments and then do some sort of final rulemaking. I guess, you know, regulatory from a regulatory standpoint, this isn't a particularly complicated thing. You know, what's going to happen is after that, after they do this proposed rulemaking and, you know, actually, you know, put a rule out there, there's probably going to be another round of legal challenges. I guess the question from the legal standpoint we want to do is, you know, from what we've seen, do we think that they've got a good argument for this reclassification? You know, basically what the court said in the Comcast case was the way you've historically treated broadband and the way that you in fact interpret your own statutes, you don't have the power to regulate it. So how is this end run going to work? Any thoughts?
Well, they're going to give themselves the power to regulate it by basically reclassifying it as a common carrier and subject to their regulation. It's the way for them to do it, right? I mean, this is, they go to Congress, they get approval for these changes, and now they can regulate it, right? That's sort of the, I mean, it's not even a runaround, it's kind of the front door method.
They have to, I thought that they were going to try to reclassify it themselves without having to go to Congress. I thought that was, Dave, I mean, can you chime in if I'm wrong? But I thought that was, you know, that's what the interesting thing here is that they're not asking, they're not going back to Congress, or at least, you know, one of the paths that they're considering isn't going to Congress and asking for more power or to do that. They internally are going to reclassify it as a common carrier as opposed to an information service.
Right. So what we're actually talking about here, I believe, is they're trying to amend their own regulations. And the way that agencies tend to work in the federal government is that you have a law gets passed or a bill gets passed and then enacted into law after it goes through the whole process of going through both Congress, the Senate, and then being signed by the president. And that authorizes the creation of an agency. And usually what happens is these bills delineate exactly what the powers of the agency are going to be, what they're going to regulate, and what they can do in terms of their power, in terms of scope of enforcement, and that sort of stuff. And then once the agency is actually created, then they tend to set up their own regulations, which actually get published to a different book, I guess you could say. It's a different type of publication. We call it the Federal Registrar, and the Federal Registrar has all of the regulations for agencies in it. We usually just abbreviate to CFR. And within those, then the agency sets up sort of how it wants to regulate whatever it is that it regulates. And for the FCC, we're talking about regulating the telecommunications and that sort of stuff. So the amendment, the proposed amendments that we're talking about are them modifying their own regulations in order to gain the power to or have the authority over this type of broadband and being able to levy those types of new regulations that would pertain to net neutrality.
Right, and the problem with the old way was that as an information service, the FCC didn't have the power to, you know, impose those kind of regulations, the net neutrality regulations, but under this new regulatory scheme, they could. But I mean, I'm still stuck on the point that how can a regulatory agency that under one scheme didn't have power to regulate something can just, you know, snap its fingers, do some proposed rulemaking, and suddenly have power to regulate something that they didn't have power to regulate before. You know, that seems contrary to, you know, courts even. This isn't even Congress saying, okay, we'll give you the power to do this, and, you know, court, you can go away
Yeah.
because Congress has the end say in this is, you know, long as it's constitutional. But this, it strikes me as I wish I had a better word for strange that a person,
An agent.
an agency could do that. It's just essentially grant themselves more power than they previously had by reclassifying something.
Well, I think one of the things that struck me about it was just, you know, the sort of changing nature of the internet and these other services, because this is all coming from the Telecommunications Act of 1996, and I think it's no stretch of the imagination to say that, you know, stuff's changed since 1996. And the original division, I believe, was between telecommunications, information services, and cable television. And now it seems like there's a bit of one of the problems with how that was laid out in this original act was that there's a lot of overlap between those categories now. There's no provisions for things like voice over IP or, you know, the fact that your cable company is your, you know, information service and things like that. So, I mean, I guess at the core, these are still the same sort of services, but, you know, it seems like the change in classification and expanding their regulatory power to control the internet service providers as well seems like an extension of that changing definition, at least to me.
I mean, the real problem here is that so you have this the bill which delineates exactly what the FCC can do that was passed by Congress and that was signed into law. That there should be the primary instance of where we look to what the FCC can actually do. And if it's just the case that the FCC is interpreting those guidelines that are enacted that were enacted by Congress or by the President and Congress, then, you know, that's really going to determine what exactly they can do in terms of modifying their own regulations and expanding their own scope. But what that's doing to me is it's really getting around the legislative process. I mean, if the problem is that the statute is not up to date, which, you know, the statute that explains what the FCC can do is not up to date, then there needs to be amendments to it, and there needs to be some sort of legislative process that goes on. And, yeah, I know, this opens the door to politics, and everyone's got a different opinion, and, you know, we'll hear about it all over CNN or whatever, but that's the way that the, you know, modifying these types of things works. And so I would just be a little bit concerned that an agency is sort of not, I don't know that we could say that they're quite stepping outside of their bounds just yet, but they're definitely going about this in an interesting way.
I guess personally, I would be less concerned about the agency overstepping their bounds there than the Comcast overstepping their bounds of what I want my internet service provider to do, but that's opinion, so.
And the other thing that's troubling, too, is that we already had, as we mentioned at the beginning of the story, we already had a court which basically says you do not have the authority to regulate this area. And so by, you know, modifying these types of things, modifying the, you know, their own regs, it just takes it in a completely different route, and it's like it's creating a new justification for their own regulation, too. Self-legislation, perhaps, I don't know. It's definitely opening the door to a many legal challenges, I'm sure, down the line here.
Yeah, absolutely. Any concluding thoughts? Dominic, you've been quiet for a little while. Anything you want to chime in and add? Or?
It'll be interesting to see whether Comcast and other groups that are going to be impacted by these change regulations will try to say that they don't have, that the FCC doesn't have the power to change its regulations like this. So, especially in this area, considering some of their prior statements. I don't think they'll be successful, but if it impacts their business, I imagine that they'll try to at least raise the issue.
Yeah, I agree. I think the most interesting question here is whether or not the FCC will have the power to change how broadband is defined, not whether or not once they change it, they have the power to enact the regulations that they want to. David or David, any last thoughts?
I'm sorry.
Okay, in that case, I think David O'Brien has our next story. I'll toss it over to you.
Well, yeah, it turns out the FCC just can't stay out of the news this week. Another story that relates to the FCC is a story about selectable output controls. And selectable output controls pertain to the way in which content gets protected as it gets delivered to you from your cable provider. So if you're watching TV and let's say a particular program pops up, if selectable output controls are enabled on your box, basically the program can come with a little bit of code with it which actually shuts off certain output controls on the back of your receiver. So, and this is your cable box receiver, so that you can't use those outputs then to, say, port the audio and the video into your computer and then copy that content onto your computer, or maybe put into a different device, like if this was, I don't know, 1995 or something like that, like port it over to your VCR and hit record. In other words, to make copies of that content, or either just to sort of pipe it around to different places. Well, since about 2003, there was a rule in place which says that those selectable output controls were prohibited. It was not allowed. Basically, the manufacturers of these devices and the content producers were not allowed to include the code which would then turn on selectable output controls and turn off some of those outputs on the back of your receivers. And the whole reason for this, apparently, and this comes out as part of this FCC opinion, which is all part of this, is that back in 2003, when HDTVs were sort of the new thing, the FCC was really concerned that because of the changing standards and the types of outputs that people had on their HDTVs, that if selectable output controls were put or suddenly turned on, or if the code was included with the content as it gets sent over the cable to your home, you would basically render those TVs useless, at least for that content that was being sent, and so people wouldn't be able to view their high-definition content. And the MPAA, which is just one of the other trade, the trade groups, one of the groups that represents a lot of other, a lot of the content makers and producers themselves, sent a challenge to the FCC, and they want this rule modified and amended so that they can start to include selectable output controls, but only for new and recent theatrical releases that will go to your home, apparently. This is where sort of the source of contention arises. They wanted the rule to be amended outright, and so that just they could include selectable output controls with whatever content that they sent. And now they're saying, well, we just want it for theatrical releases. So in other words, movies that have just come out in the theater, you might soon be able to view in your home. And the FCC granted this request in part, but eventually they modified the underlying language, which would actually amend this. And they also left open the door to go back and revisit this issue as well. So throwing this over to the panel now, do you guys have any initial thoughts on selectable output controls or any close interaction with them? This isn't something that I have a ton of experience in.
The only experience that I've seen with it is there's part of the HDMI spec is called HDCP. I think it stands for High Definition Copy Protection, and that will prevent certain content from being played on certain screens. One thing I couldn't figure out is, you know, yes, this is a standard that the FCC is giving an okay for, but is this already in televisions that have been sold recently? Like, the selectable output control as opposed to HDCP, or does anyone know if, you know, they're going to implement the selective output control through HDCP?
My understanding was that it was primarily through HDCP and HDMI. So basically what the selectable output controls would do is force you to use that HDMI port on the back of your receivers. Now, interestingly, this rule, and the rule that dates back to 2003, said nothing about the ability of manufacturers to include the hardware that would allow this to happen. This really just had to do with the code being included with content as it was sent over cable.
Okay, so if it only has to do with cable, then this is the kind of thing that Comcast would be able to, Comcast or Time Warner or, you know, RCN or whoever your provider is, they would be able to implement it and you know, do that on their side. We wouldn't have to worry about this going through the TV. Or would we? Because, I mean, once the cable goes into the TV, I don't know. I'm confused about how this will work technically.
Well, so think of it like this. You have your coax cable, right? You have your content coming in over the coax cable, and then it goes into your cable box, right? And then out of the cable box are those outputs on the back of the cable box, and from there you can connect, say, an additional receiver for, like, a home audio theater, or maybe you just want to plug it in directly into your TV. And traditionally they had the three color-coded white, yellow, and red ports on the back, and you could plug in, those were multi-purpose plugs, and you could basically take the feeds out, like say the video feed, which I believe is the yellow one, and then the white and red corresponded to the left and right audio channels, I believe. So you could basically take that right out of the cable box as it was coming into your home. Now what this is doing is basically shutting down all of those, but and forcing you just to use that new little HDMI slot in the back, which, if memory serves, it combines both video and audio into a single port.
Okay, that makes
sense.
Does
that make more sense now?
I mean, this seems like there are going to be a reasonable number of people who still use the component jacks, the, you know, the three individual ones for HD, who are going to be very mad when they suddenly try to play a new movie, you know, a streaming movie on their through their cable box and can't do it through their component jacks. They, you know, it says to view this movie you have to use HDMI. I mean, lame.
Well, you're absolutely right, and I think the estimates are somewhere between 11 and 25 million television sets are old enough that this would affect them in some way. Basically, this has always been referred to as the analog loophole. So televisions that still rely on that, I don't want to call them more primitive, but just the different analog outputs rather than these new digital outputs. And someone could correct me if I'm wrong, too. I've heard that there isn't that much of a difference between HDMI and then the standard analog outputs.
Well, component can do up to 1080i, but it can't do, if I'm remembering correctly, 1080p. So if that's the case, there's not a whole lot of difference, because my guess is most people can't tell the difference between 1020p and 1080p on a standard TV. And yes, one of my current television is one of the ones that does not have HDMI. It does have a DVI port, though, so, you know, I've got that going for me.
Yeah, I think HDCP also was connected to the DVI ports too, but that's a good question. So in any event, I think what a lot of people are concerned about is that even though the scope of this ruling is so small, the MPAA seems to have won a small little chunk of argument here that selectable output controls should basically be available as an option to them in order to control piracy or attempt to control piracy.
Yeah, I mean, that strikes me as a red herring, because piracy is going to happen regardless of whether or not you have these output controls, and the leak does not count, start at a cable box. If anywhere the leak starts at, you know, a DVD screener or a pre-release or somebody who records the film in the movie theater, I don't think that, you know, that was a justifiable reason to implement this.
Well, it's interesting. They're terming, the MPAA, that is terming this very high value and sought after content. And we were talking about movies that have just been released into the theater, and they're thinking that this is going to be available for busy parents and people who can't get out of the house because they couldn't get a babysitter. They're going to be able now to sit on their home couch and watch the same theatrical releases that people are actually going out to the theaters to see. But what they're saying here is, like, we're not going to do this unless we have this type of content protection available, because we believe that this is going to be another vector, basically, for people to copy the content. And if there's no way to protect the content through the selectable output controls, they're going to be able to outright copy it out of the analog ports on the back of the receiver, basically.
That makes sense. I mean, that is the way to. And analog controls will give you a pretty damn good copy.
Right, but how far in advance of the DVD release of Avatar did the DVD of Avatar leak on the web?
So far, far ahead.
Yeah,
it's not the primary channel.
That's a good point.
Like most channels out there are going to be based off of internal gold copies, basically, that someone leaked and ripped.
Right, so. This isn't where people are pirating things. I mean, whatever. The FCC can do it if they want. I just don't think that they have a good reason for doing it. You'd never convince a court of that, though. Especially because, you know, on review of something like this, they'd have to find that the FCC's findings were arbitrary and capricious, and that's just not the case. I mean, they were stupid, but they weren't arbitrary or capricious.
I have to be a little bit sympathetic to the MPAA here, because I think they are right to say that if they were going to release movies that are out in the theater right now, say Iron Man 2, for instance, if they were planning to release that as available over like a pay-per-view system or Comcast on-demand system, that they would certainly be worried about people copying them and then putting up copies on the internet. And the problem, though, I think that people point to is that the MPAA can't really quantify how much piracy is actually going on out there as a result of just people jacking into the back of their receivers, copying something, and then putting it up on the internet. But at the same time, though, that's really hard stuff to track, because there isn't, you know, we're not talking about things that usually have watermarks or any ways that you can discern how a person actually facilitated the copying before they put them online.
Right, that's a fair point. With a DVD screener, you know, there are watermarks, so you can determine, you know, who leaked it and keep them from getting screeners in the future. And, you know, there's probably a way to track it with a gold master, you know, just because only so many people would have access to those things. But, you know, with this, it would be a lot harder.
So do you guys have any thoughts on the broader issue of whether or not the FCC should allow selectable output controls in general for all types of content, including all televisions, not just pay-per-view things that, you know, are looking for theatrical releases?
The liberal in me wants to say, get your hands off of my television, you know, step away. This isn't, there are better regulatory mechanisms for this, like, you know, criminal responsibility and, you know, trying to affect social change through, you know, education campaigns, you know, than making it physically impossible to do something, especially when that physical impossibility may cut people out of getting content or may make it more difficult for some people to get content. But at this point, I've thrown up my hands and just, you know, don't know what else I can do.
To me, this seems like one of those technologies that seems like it, you know, okay, that might make sense, But it, in some ways, it's like the DRM that they put into Blu-ray these days, or in certain video games where, yeah, you think it should work, but then there comes the case where it doesn't work, and people who have the content legally aren't able to access it, and then the people who have it illegally are able to access it. So, I don't know. I would err on the side of less regulation, but that's, again, just personal preference.
Dominic?
I agree with Ben that this isn't even where the piracy is happening, so it kind of seems a lot of effort for little gain. But at the same time, I mean, if this is what it's going to take to let the studios feel comfortable releasing stuff earlier, then I'm in favor of it just because I would like earlier releases.
And on the broader issue of, say, should we allow selectable output controls, the code which enables them to be included with TV and other types
Sure.
of stuff? Is that an affirmative yes? You would like to see that
Yeah,
included?
I think we should see it. I mean, it should be permissible if there are companies that feel that they, I mean, it seems like, I guess there isn't, I'm kind of trying to make the let the market decide argument, although I'm not sure whether it'll hold here because you've got a regulatory agency. But I guess if, I mean, I guess I'm not clear on one thing. Is the FCC mandating this in all televisions?
No, they're just allowing it, basically,
They're
for
allowing it. So it's a choice that TV manufacturers can
right.
make. So theoretically, there could be some studios that will do early releases without selectable output control, and theoretically, there could be some electronics manufacturer who makes stuff without selectable output control. And theoretically, if the market truly prefers that, then that would happen. But I think the problem is we see that we only have a couple studios on the market, so we don't really have a true free market because it's basically just three or four big studios and not that many electronics manufacturers. So.
There's I don't know. Sometimes I worry about allowing, say, the Hollywood industry to control what devices we can plug in to our set-top boxes or our TVs, because it seems to sort of we are actually like relinquishing control over the way that we have our home audio set up, all plugged in together. Now we're forced to use certain ports on the back or forced to use certain cables and. Just from the standpoint of a consumer, I kind of like to have control over all of that stuff so I can keep things in check rather than having to rely on what somebody tells me that I have to use.
I can certainly see that point of view as well.
A lot of people liken this to breaking their TVs, in other words. But there is probably a good way to implement something like this because if you think about it, at least for what the FCC is allowing now, it just has to do with basically pay-per-view type events for allowing theatrical releases. Then all the distributors, say like Comcast and stuff, can then require people to have a certain type of cable box, which maybe only has a HDCP compliant HDMI connection that plugs into their TV on the back. So that way you know that the person, is up to spec, and it's not going to cause any problems if they try to purchase the theatrical release and the pay-per-view, and so rather than seeing that blank screen with static in front of them, they're actually enjoying the picture itself. Anyone else have any thoughts?
I'm all set.
Okay, well, I think our third story will be introduced today by Dominic. Dominic, why don't you take it away for us?
So the New York Post put out a story a couple days ago saying that supposedly the U.S. Department of Justice and the Federal Trade Commission are considering whether or not they should start an antitrust inquiry against Apple. The speculation in the Post, I think, said that it was because of Apple's decision not to use Flash in their products, but another Mac magazine or a Mac website called 9 to 5 Mac speculated that it was actually because of Apple's new iPhone Developer Program license agreement, which, interestingly, has some provisions that weren't there before. Specifically, Apple bans third-party rapid application development tools and restricts unauthorized programming code. In other words, if you're writing iPhone or iPad apps, you can't use a third-party tool to make that easier. if that third-party tool is one that Apple doesn't like. Theoretically, if it's one that Apple does like, they won't bother you about it. But they basically give themselves wide license to control how developers can even write programs for the iPhone and iPad platform.
Right. I think the main relevant example is Adobe in Flash for CS5 or Adobe Flash CS5 had a feature in it in which you could compile a Flash program to work natively on an iPhone. And Apple revised their terms of service to basically say, you know what, no, we're not going to allow this. If you're developing for the iPhone, we want you to develop for the iPhone, not to develop for something else and just have the iPhone, have it work on the iPhone in addition to other things. So, you know, that's where this is coming from. The language enveloped some other programming tools into it, you know, things that would let you compile. I think there's one that let you compile C# code to work on the iPhone, and there's one or two others as well. But the main target of this was Flash. The other thing that was raised in the more recent coverage is that Apple, with iPhone 4.0, which is coming out this summer, is going to have a new iAd service. So Apple is going to be selling ads to people and then letting you decide whether or not you want to put those ads in your app, and you'll get a split. I think it's 60-40, 60 to Apple, 40 to you, for showing those ads in your app. Apple, however, prohibits using location-based information, prohibits third parties from using location-based information to serve up those ads. But there's no indication that Apple's going to impose the same limitation on themselves. So that's another thing that's at least putatively drawing some antitrust scrutiny.
I think one thing that also was troubling, at least to some people, was that the announcement to the change in the SDK license came right before Adobe was going to announce their new version of Flash or whatever that had that tool. So some people saw it as anti-competitive to, you know, right before they had this big announcement of this feature of the development Flash development environment that they had put a lot of work and money into, that Apple changed the license.
Are we just getting to the end of closed development environments, basically, for certain hardware platforms?
What do you mean?
Are we just going to get to a point where the regulatory commissions here in the U.S. are going to open these things up and require, or not require, well, I guess, yeah, sort of require the companies to allow all sorts of different third-party application programming interfaces? It feels a little similar in an odd way to some of the aspects of net neutrality.
I don't think that the so in this case, the two agencies that would be looking into this are the Federal Trade Commission, the FTC, not the FCC. I know we've had slip-ups on the podcast before when we've been talking about both of those agencies in the same podcast. So FTC and the Department of Justice, they have an antitrust division that may also be looking into this. In the end, I don't think they're going to take any action on this. We discussed earlier that a main factor in this is market power, and that again, depending on how they end up, they being the agency, it defines market power. You're going to have a tough time finding that Apple has market power in, you know, anything other than apps for the iPhone. You know, mobile apps in general, there's a lot of competition. Mobile phones, there's a lot of competition. Smartphones, there's even a lot of competition. You know, even smartphone OSs. So you have to define that market so narrowly as to, you know, kind of eliminate the idea that there's a market in general, as opposed to a distinct market for each and every subset of these things. I don't believe that the FTC or the DOJ would try to get Apple to open up their development.
That makes sense as well. To sort of reiterate the free market perspective, one of the things about antitrust is that you have to define your market. And as I think Ben pointed out, Apple doesn't have a monopoly on mobile devices by any stretch of the imagination. What they do have a monopoly on is Apple devices, but that's not a monopoly because those are their own devices. The iPhone obviously doesn't just compete with the iPhone, it competes with all of their smartphones on the market.
And the other thing that I think often gets overlooked is the difference between a monopoly and market power when you're doing an antitrust analysis. So it's not enough just to have a monopoly. You have to have some power over the market. So even if I have a patent for screwdrivers, that is a terrible example for so many reasons, a patent for a specific drug, that doesn't mean that I have market power over the drug. I won't necessarily be able to set whatever price I want for that drug. You know, the market will bear a certain price or it won't bear a certain price. You know, when you have market power, I don't think I'm doing a very good job explaining this. Anyone want to jump in and try to save me?
Now, I think what you're trying to get at is that they have to have the ability to influence the market. There are some markets out there which have a very small number of competitors in them, so we usually think of those as like oligopolies or markets where the people at the top are so few that even if you tried to do something that was inherently anti-competitive, they wouldn't be able to influence the prices enough in order to make a change in the market in terms of pricing and to shift the supply enough or to create some sort of schism that would cause them to have a competitive advantage over everybody else. Is that what you're trying to get at, Ben?
Basically,
you go, Dominic.
Well, the textbook definition of market power is that a company with market power can raise prices without losing to the competitors that it has, without losing its customers to competitors. So, say that Microsoft has operating systems that they sell. If they have market power, then they can say, you know what, we're going to charge $1,000 for Windows because people don't have any other operating systems that they'd want to use because so many applications run on Windows. Let's do that. We'll just charge $1,000 per copy of Windows. And because we have so much market power, customers won't balk and run away or go use another operating system because they're tied to Windows, because their applications require Windows, etc., etc. So that's sort of the classic example of market power.
Right. I guess if we were applying it here, it's that Apple could put more restrictions on the development and people would not go to alternatives. I mean, that's the best way that I can think of it, but that's not really, yeah. I mean,
so
in the end, that's...
Say,
you go, Dominic.
Apple can say that we can restrict you from using third-party applications to develop for the iPhone, and you know what? Developers are still going to develop for the iPhone because the iPhone platform is better than all the other platforms out there, and customers won't go to iPhone's competitors, so developers won't go to iPhone competitors, and they'll put up whatever onerous terms we decide to saddle them with in the license agreement because they don't have anywhere else to go.
Yeah, I guess the next step of that is once you show that they have market power, which I think there's at least a decent argument that Apple has market power in, again, if we're defining the market as iPhone apps. The next step is that there has to be some sort of anti-competitive practice. You know, something that Apple's doing has to violate antitrust law. And in this case, it doesn't sound like it would be any type of collusion with somebody else. It would have to be some sort of other anti-competitive practice. Like an example would be price gouging or tying.
Yeah, and I'm not sure what the anti-competitive behavior is. In some ways, they're just making it so that fewer apps are coming out of the App Store. But they're doing this on purpose because they don't want people to be porting apps to the Apple iPhone. They want people writing apps fresh because that way they'll take advantage of the user interface guidelines and work like an iPhone app. It's very important for that consistent user interface. That's something that Apple prizes.
Yeah, and Steve Jobs pointed out in an open letter to, I guess, the community, but in the end it was a letter to Adobe that basically said the problem with Flash on the iPhone is that if you're, one, writing for Flash, Flash has a lot of rollovers, and there's no way to do a rollover on an iPhone. You know, when you can't hover your cursor over something when there's no cursor. The second problem, he said, is that we want people to develop for the iPhone and not develop for every smartphone because, you know, we constantly are adding new features and capabilities to our phones and, you know, we don't want people to be developing to the lowest common denominator. We want people to be developing to the iPhone and the features that the iPhone has.
So the last thing that I had read seemed to indicate that either the DOJ or the FTC had not come out and actually acknowledged that they were in fact investigating or doing an inquiry to Apple. Did you guys catch that too?
I haven't seen anything.
Yeah,
Just that this is basically all hearsay at this point. I mean, this came out from inside sources, I think, from a New York Post article.
Right, and then the Wall Street Journal picked it up afterward, which my guess would mean that somebody else confirmed it to the Wall Street Journal. They don't tend to report on things willy-nilly. But yes, last I heard, neither the Department of Justice nor the Federal Trade Commission had said that Apple was being investigated. They kind of did a no comment and moved on.
Fair enough. So, well, I guess in the meantime, we'll just have to wait and see if either of those regulatory agencies come out with anything specific.
Any closing thoughts, David Liu?
I'm still a little hesitant to call everything that Apple is doing not anti-competitive, but it's tough for me to form a legal argument around that. So, I think I'll just have to wait and see if they do anything else that more strictly impinges on the law.
There is one thing that I wanted to mention. One of the arguments that I mentioned earlier was that Apple doesn't allow third parties to use location-based ads, and the implication is that Apple itself would do location-based ads. From what I've been hearing about the people who Apple is targeting with these ads, that's not going to be an issue. You know, they're targeting large national chains, major retailers, those kind of people. I mean, it's not the kind of thing where you'd be worried about, you know, Apple saying, oh, it looks like you're in Cambridge. Here's an ad for a coffee shop that's exclusive to Cambridge. It's going to be, oh, you're looking at, you know, something about computers. Here's an ad for Best Buy. Shoes running, here's an ad for Nike.
How is that last bit location-based?
It's not location-based, is what I'm saying, is that, you know, the worry was that Apple would be doing location-based ads, and from what I've been hearing, they're targeting, you know, large national companies, not local companies, with their, at least their first round of ad sales. So it doesn't look like they're aiming at doing location-based. If anything, you know, they're doing broad national campaigns where people can get in and get their advertising across the entire continent, and it would be effective wherever it is.
All right. I guess, any other closing thoughts, David O'Brien?
Not really. I mean, you can't... I'm a little hesitant to fault these guys for what seem to be good business practices, so until something comes out that's a little bit more specific... in terms of anti-competitive behavior, you know, I don't know that there's too much to add here.
Well, in that case, that wraps up Podcast 49. I'm Dominic Rabi, and with me today were...
Ben Snitkoff.
David Liu.
And David O'Brien.
Thank you all for listening. Check us out on Twitter at @TechLegal. Visit our website at technicallylegal.org, and email us with suggestions and thoughts for the podcast at podcast@technicallylegal.org. Thank you.
Hello and welcome to the Technically... Oh, God. This is
going to
be a long podcast.
Wah, wah, wah.